But I really don't have any regrets. I really don't. I've lived exactly how I've wanted to. I've tried my hardest every single time. I didn't win the matches that maybe I should have always won. But I really gave it my all, so that for me is enough.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to The Body Serve. I'm Jonathan.
I'm James.
Episode 335 of The Body Serve. We're getting up there. We're getting up there in age, in years, in life, and as podcasters.
Longevity, they call it.
Not everybody has those, you know? Let's start with another retraction.
Wow. You can't even bury that in the middle of the episode, huh?
Let's get it out of the way.
Another correction. I just need to stop. I'll just stick with more fantastical endeavors. Allegedly, I made another...
It's alleged.
Another mistake on the last episode. No, I can't actually remember what I said, but I may have said that Mencheek played his first slam main draw in this past Australian Open. Morey discovered that was a lie. He, of course, played the US Open main draw in 2023, and he reached the third round, losing to Taylor Fritz.
Is that all accurate, what you just said?
Yes. I'm not going to correct a correction. At that point, it's fake news, and it's just going to live on its own.
Okay. Let's begin this week in Acapulco. A soft launch for the episode before we get into some of the more explosive stuff. We've been doing more weekly podcasts. And I don't know if you've noticed that the length of the episodes have been maybe a little bit shorter because, you know, when you record that often, for us at least, the agenda is more sparse. And after the last episode, I think it was our shortest episode in a year, roughly.
Oh, wow.
I was like, what's the next agenda going to look like? And boy, do we have a lot to cover on this episode. Alex Dumanar, back-to-back in Acapulco, continues his incredible start to the year, really.
Yeah.
Beating Casper Ruud in the final. It's back-to-back weeks losing in a final for Casper Ruud.
Alex got his very first win over Stefanos Tsitsipas in 11 tries. He is now 1-10 against Stefanos. That happened in the quarterfinals here.
His year so far, he made the Rotterdam final. He also has wins over Djokovic, Zverev, and Fritz, all of those at the United Cup. Along with wins over Dimitrov, Rublev, Ruud, Tsitsipas. He entered the top 10 for the first time 2 weeks ago, and here he is again. Enter the top 10 and then you have some big points to defend. The worry there for him is, oh boy, will I be able to hang on to the top 10 right after I get there? And he doesn't.
Dumanar has been on a steady incline since last year. He reached four finals last year, including winning Acapulco, that was Queen's Club, Los Cabos, and then his biggest final ever, which was in Toronto at the Canadian Open. And then this year, of course, he reached the Rotterdam final, lost a Sinner, and now he's in the top 10, has some time to celebrate in Acapulco, and then jets off to San Diego.
Why? Because girlfriend Katie Bolter wins the 500 in San Diego, and he's there to watch her do it. Power couple.
Right, the tennis it couple right now. I don't want to make comparisons to other tennis it couples. Frankly, it does not interest me. But
you mean to tell me they're not the Steffi and Andre of tennis right now?
But just like Alex, Katie has been on a serious career incline, even more dramatic than her boyfriend's. Last time this year, she was ranked 151. She gained some points playing ITF tournaments in the spring, wins Nottingham for her first WTA title, third round finishes at Wimbledon in the US Open, and then she started this year ranked 56, rises to 27 with this title in San Diego.
She beats Marta Kostyuk 5-7, 6-2, 6-2 in the final. As for who she beat this week, Sorenko, Haddad Maia, Vekic, Emma Navarro, and, as I said, Kostyuk in the final. These two wins this week, I think, are good examples of right now in tennis, we have so many players maybe not top players, but so many players playing the best tennis of their life. Mm-hmm. Bolter, de Munar, Baez, winning back-to-back weeks, Draper, Emma Navarro. Like, she's been playing well for quite a while now.
Right. Yuan Yue, who won the Austin title against her countrywoman Wang Shiyu.
Kostyuk, loser in this final. She had a good run at the Australian Open.
Mm-hmm. And it shows you a lot about those players who are smart at scheduling, who are picking the correct tournaments. Baez is probably the prime example of that, winning his sixth career title, again in South America, this time in Chile. It's nice to finally see something of a South American and, shall we say, Mesoamerican swing leading up to the United States hardcourt events. We've even got a little WTA swing in the U.S. leading toward Indian Wells. I mentioned Baez, who just won his sixth career title, is up to number 5 in the current ATP race. He defeated Alejandro Tabilo, who is a Chilean player you may have heard of, was the runner-up last year in Cordoba. And then in Austin, Texas, we've got another kind of pre-Indian Wells U.S. hardcourt event. Yuan Yue and Wang Shiyu are in the final.
Yue moves to a career high number 49 and is now the third highest ranked Chinese player on the WTA Tour. Also in Austin, a name you may have forgotten about, Anastasia Sevastova. She's been off the tour since 2022. She had a child. She's back. She made the quarterfinals of this tournament, having to retire against Shmidlova. Mind you, she was up a set when she had to retire in that match. Good form. Beat Sloane Stephens easily in the round prior.
Her real return to the main draw was earlier in February in Transylvania Open, where she beat Andrea Mitu and Avanesyan. And she had played 2 WTA 125s at the end of last year. But before that, she was away from the tour for almost 2 full years. She had a baby in December 2022. And now she's back from maternity leave. I remember watching her, it must have been 2019 in Cincinnati. She's been around forever. She is quite a character. Nobody forgets watching her.
Former US Open semifinalist.
Yes. Right?
The other big tournament this week was in Dubai. The men playing in Dubai after the women had previously completed their tournament. This tournament was kind of run-of-the-mill, ho-hum. By the time you got to the semifinal stages, Daniil Medvedev had a legit shot at defending a title for the first time in his career. That did not happen when he ended up losing to the eventual winner, Hugo Humbert. Another player who is playing the best tennis of their life right now. Humbert is playing lights out at the moment. In that final, Humbert beats Bublik, somebody else who is playing a lot of good tennis, 6-4, 6-3 for his sixth ATP title. Now, on a regular week, that would have been maybe the most noteworthy aspect of this tournament. But the real news happened in the semifinal, where Bublik beat a defaulted Andrei Rublev, up 6-5 in the third set.
Yeah, the scoreline was 6-7, 7-6, 6-5-D. Never like to see that lowercase d next to your name. All right, what happened? It's 5-all in the third set. Bublik is serving. Bublik hits a ball on Andrei's baseline that is close. The point continues. Andre hits a ball long and then gestures at the line, basically indicating that that ball a few balls prior was long. You should have called it. He was out of challenges, so he couldn't stop the point. He promptly goes over to the line umpire at that baseline, waves his racket toward his face, gets in his face, and screams. That's what we saw.
Repeatedly.
Right. Pretty close to him, right in his face, screaming. Now, do you react well when people do that to you? Is that something that typically happens to you?
Let alone if a racket was in my face.
Right. Now, we on camera couldn't tell what was said, but all of this is unfolding very quickly. The line umpire who was near the happenings over there runs to the chair umpire, as they're supposed to do, tells the chair what happened, that he's a Russian speaker, and this is what he heard.
Claims that Rublev swore at the line judge in Russian. Rublev denies it and says that he was speaking English.
Right. The supervisor is quickly on court. Supervisor is the one who goes over to Andre and tells him what happened. He brings that umpire over and says, listen, this guy is a Russian speaker. This is what he said, you said. He alleged that there were profanities in Russian used against this guy. There's not much of a conversation. And pretty quickly after that, Andre is defaulted from the match. While all this was going on, there was so much emphasis on the evidence about what alleged profanities were uttered in Russian, whether he was speaking Russian at all, I can't tell. I've seen people say he said something in Russian, then most of the tirade was in English.
I also don't care.
Right.
I think what he said was immaterial to him being defaulted. Well, immaterial to him needing to be defaulted.
Yes.
It makes it worse if he were swearing at the umpire in whatever language, but the mere act of physical aggression by being in this umpire's space like that so aggressively, to me, that's enough to default a player. Now, what do the rules say about that?
The rules, as usual, say that the umpire has discretion. The umpire must either follow the point penalty schedule, or they can default a player for a single violation of the code if they deem it worthy or egregious enough. The point penalty schedule is the typical warning, then point penalty, then game penalty, which we've seen very often. It's what happened to Serena Williams and, of course, that 2018 U.S. Open final, which, of course, that came up again.
Of course.
In the ensuing discourse.
Of course. Of course.
To answer your question, the umpire has some discretion here. They can levy a default if they feel that the violation is bad enough. The outcome is that Andre was defaulted from the match. Bublik is the winner. He moves on to the final. Typically, a defaulted player is penalized all of their ranking points and all of the prize money that they would have earned that week. Originally, the penalty was $150,000 in prize money, plus whatever fine is levied, and he would have lost all 200 points from the week. Today, the ATP came out and overturned the decision upon appeal. This was a quick investigation. Don't you wish all investigations could be this quick? Maybe not this quick, but they gathered evidence and testimony from players, from the umpires, from everybody involved, and said that based on the evidence, the full penalty would have been disproportionate in this case. Instead, they let Andre keep his points, his prize money, but fined him $36,400, which they'll take out of the prize money.
Now, Rublev, in the wake of this news that the prize money and the points will be kept, this overturning, he takes to Instagram to definitely not apologize.
No, there was none of that.
Certainly wasn't that. He says, quote, I want to thank the appeal committee for approving my appeal and changing course on the ATP's initial decision of disqualifying me from the Dubai semifinal and taking away the rankings points and prize money I earned last week. I hope that in the future, the ATP will take a closer look at this rule and make changes to it so that an official can't force a match outcome without having clear evidence and not letting the player have a video review. While I'm disappointed that I wasn't able to finish my semifinal in Dubai, I'm grateful for all the support I had from you the last 2 days. I received a lot of messages. Thank you to everyone supporting me. I promise I will learn from this and will try to be a better player and better person.
The last line is what's being pulled and used in news stories and tweets and headlines. That was not the thesis statement, I would say. Right? That was a gesture toward, oh, there may have been wrongdoing here. I'm not apologizing. I'm not saying I should have acted differently. I'm thanking the ATP for making the right decision in restoring my points and prize money, and it's too bad that I got defaulted. There was no contrition there.
There was no, I acted inappropriately, and I apologize to that man for getting in his personal space and for screaming in his face, for wielding my racket, perhaps not threateningly, but still wielding my racket in his direction. None of that. That was a sequence of events orchestrated and performed by Andre himself that set this whole thing into motion. There was no, to my mind, accountability, true accountability taken for what happened.
And why should he feel he needs to take accountability when all current and former players rallied around him? And this is, maybe I'll get to this in a moment, but this is why I think commentators who are not former players are actually quite integral to the whole process. Because otherwise you get this kind of clubbish, jockish atmosphere where
You've never played. Right. You've never been in those situations.
You can't comment. You can't. You've never played. But we are also human beings, right? A lot of people bring insights to talking about sports who have never played on a professional level.
Andy Roddick said, quote, "He will have some of the blame because he went too far. But taking the money for the week, taking away the points because of a judgment call of some guy in a chair, that doesn't make sense to me."
Right. Some guy in a chair.
Yeah. Who is that person?
These are also professionals. Right. I know you think they're just people who like walk up to the court and do a shitty job.
That is so demeaning to the umpire. Right. Some guy in a chair. It necessarily calls into question their judgment.
Well, of course.
For everything.
Right. But it is in keeping with how Andy Roddick often treated officials of the game during his own playing career. Mm-hmm. It doesn't surprise me that he thinks this way. Now, do I think that Andy Roddick brings a ton of great insight, and I'm glad he's in the commentary space or the podcasting space. But I think you have to back up from your history as a player here.
He will have some of the blame? Who bears the rest of the blame?
Even if the call is wrong, that sucks. I feel bad for you. And it's at an important juncture in the match, but is that the way you're supposed... I mean, are we supposed to tolerate any form of reaction? Any form of emotional dysregulation is okay because you're a player, you know what it's like to be in heat of battle, we don't. So therefore, we cannot comment. Dasha Kazatkina, TT fave, body surf fave.
Who rarely puts a foot wrong. She stepped in it this week, saying on Twitter, "So you can just default a player, take his points and money away without even checking a video replay? What a joke. Another confirmation we need a VAR in tennis and electronic line calling on all tournaments."
Alejandro Davidovich Fokina says, "Very unfair that they disqualify Rublev without first ensuring that what the line judge understood is correct. That rule should be reviewed and changed. Shameful. We need VAR in tennis." This is one of those situations where some of those things might be true, but nowhere in your tweet did you say, maybe, just maybe, it's okay to have a standard of behavior on court in the way that you treat officials. I mean, I don't disagree that there should be VAR in tennis. Follow the lead of other sports like cricket and basketball and football, like all of these sports. If the technology is available, let's look into the best way to use it.
Yes. But also, in most of those other sports, you behave like Rublev did and you get penalized with the swiftness.
Let's talk about that.
So this is yet another example where tennis behaves amateurish, where it behaves bush league, where it doesn't take itself seriously enough as a professional sporting outfit.
Tennis is supposed to be this very conservative, very uptight sport. In a way, it is conservative in how it is resistant to institutional change. A gentleman's club is actually a boys' club. It's a gentleman's sport, but it's a boys' club, right? It protects behavior like this. And what is disturbing to me is that when fellow players witness this kind of behavior, their first impulse is to say, let's remove those human beings on court because that's their fault. The player is not expected to control his emotion. You can talk to people any old kind of way, especially if you think they're wrong. And so it is, in a sense, telling me that they don't actually view those people as people.
But also, those people are people when it's somebody else attacking them. When it's a Serena Williams, when it's a woman sometimes, especially when it's a black woman.
Oh, that's interesting.
it becomes a different situation.
Right. So then the discourse becomes, well, this should have happened to Serena many times. And let's keep the facts straight here. In 2009 at the US Open, she did not technically get defaulted. She got a point penalty on match point. There was no need to escalate, right, to default. What she did warranted a default. That's something we can say 15 years later. Yes, I believe what she did warranted a default. I'm going to hold her to the same standards I would hold Andre or anybody else.
I didn't say I would kill you.
Right.
Well, ma'am, you did say you would take that ball and shove it down your fucking throat. That and kind of typically results in death.
Right. And I've said many times, if we're at the point where you have to say, I didn't say I would kill you, you're down the wrong road. We've misstepped somewhere.
Other elements of this is this whole business of snitching. Snitch, snitch, snitch. I don't like snitches. Manarino comes here and has a screen grab of what looks like the tournament director, the match referee or whatever, and the snitch in question, talking to Rublev. And he says, oh my God, coming out to snitch. Not sure how many matches McEnroe would finish in 2024. Well, nor should he, if he's going to be behaving like he did throughout his entire career, build his post-retirement legacy on it, and have the sport still trade in it.
It's like, wait, you like what McEnroe was doing back then? Well, I guess a lot of people like it. And the sport still celebrates.
You simply cannot be serious.
Chalk flew up. But what are you doing as a player taking a screenshot of a nameless line umpire who, by his contract and code of ethics, is not allowed to retaliate, is not allowed to even make any public statements about the happenings of the match? Those people should be anonymous. That's how the system is designed. It's a question of proportionality. And we'll get to in a second, there is a question of proportionality in the penalty that was levied.
Yes.
That's, I think, reasonable people. That's the only part of this that can be discussed in good faith.
Right. And so the appropriate outrage from players should have been, shame on you, Andre. Like, that was not it. But also, the tour needs to revisit the penalty process. Because that behavior in a semifinal carries different stakes than it does in a first round. It carries the loss of more points and more money for the same behavior.
Right. Now, I happen to agree with the penalty that was levied because I think we've been asking for years for tennis to protect officials in a more meaningful way. And this is really the only way, right? It's not to remove all human beings from the court because our players are so reckless and dangerous, they can't abide by the rules. Because that's what you're saying, right? You're saying that if there are people on court, our players cannot be trusted. To me, is the subtext. It's not only that these people will make mistakes because they're human, but take away the temptation for a player to cuss out and wave their racket in someone's face.
And this is not the first time Rublev has done it.
No.
Typically, he's screaming and yelling at himself and hitting himself with his racket. And that's a whole other situation, one that he's aware of and is purportedly working on, but we see it all the time. But what we've also seen is him screaming at officials, photographers. Even worse than this was how he behaved to the photographers last year.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was in Shanghai. Apparently, a photographer was clicking during a point, or they did something that made noise or distracted him during the point, and he immediately went over and screamed at them. Are you kidding me? In the middle of a point, and just went on. The same how that played out physically, in terms of how it was acted out physically, it's pretty much a carbon copy.
Right. This is someone who's shown that he has trouble controlling his emotions. And I have no interest in pathologizing or diagnosing him. I also have no interest in excusing him and saying, oh, he's really trying to get better, whatever, which is what his fandom does. If you ever bring it up, ever dare bring it up, you're not giving him any credit for trying.
Outside
maybe he's trying. However, that doesn't mean that you should excuse this type of behavior. It's not an excuse.
Has there ever been a tennis player more infantilized? Maybe other than Nadal by his...
Right. I mean, you know, the whole baby girl aesthetic, and this is common to sort of infantilize and make gentle grown men, right?
In the case of Nadal, it wasn't excusing behavior, it was like protecting him at all costs.
Right.
This fragile baby.
That he was probably the original baby girl in tennis. You know? But the question of proportionality in the decision that was made to default him, there's discussion to be had there.
Yeah.
I think that's totally fair. I was watching it very surprised that they move straight to default, because you don't really ever see this in tennis. There's very little, if any, precedent for it. What I think hurt the whole scenario is we're going on and on talking about what was allegedly said in Russian, in a language that the chair doesn't speak. We have this line umpire's eyewitness testimony. And so watching everything unfold, I was thinking, well, is it about what he supposedly said in Russian, or is it about what he did in general? Was it about this sort of like menacing stomp over to the line umpire, getting in his face, waving your racket, screaming? Is that the offense? Or is the offense a bad word? And so I think that got muddled, and it gave Andre a real inroad here for an appeal.
Mm. What was different about this situation compared to, say, the Zverev incident in Mexico too?
Right.
Last year. Well, this was in Dubai, but it's in... We're in that stretch of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And why it's sometimes compared to Plíšková, those things happened at the end of the match.
Right.
This happened during the match. And so necessarily, the treatment and the timing of the treatment is different. That said, how can the ATP, again, we can apply this to any number of situations, how can the ATP be taken seriously? How can we expect this issue to be dealt with properly when that clear-cut situation with Zverev did not lead to a suspension?
Right, right.
How can we have any credibility in this process when you've made it clear that you can get away with that behavior?
Mm-hmm.
And so by comparison, this seems like small potatoes. So why is he being defaulted
right. In
this very minor situation where he did not touch an umpire, did not touch the lines judge, he wasn't even that close.
Oh, right.
The racket wasn't that close to his face. Like, by all comparisons to all the terrible things that have been allowed to pass on the ATP in the past, this is small potatoes. So why are we here?
Right.
Justice for Rublev.
Like, are we really parsing how many inches or centimeters he was away from the person? Like I said, if we're parsing, oh, he wasn't that close, oh, I didn't say I would kill you, we have wandered down the wrong road.
And again, I've said this before in the podcast, this is where it comes back to fuck John McEnroe. And everybody in tennis and everybody in sport who have celebrated that kind of behavior. I mean, some will make the argument that it helped build the profile of tennis.
Sure, but I mean, we keep hearing this without evidence, right? It's always, well, tennis needs personalities. We need blood and fire. And like, yeah, okay. Yeah, we do. That's correct. But was the Big Four era a flop era? Because nobody was really cussing out umpires, well, except one of them. Like, it doesn't hold a lot of water to me. You don't need everyone to be a Nick Kyrgios to generate interest in tennis. You really don't.
This stuff is inescapable. Do you remember that the Breakpoint Season 1 opened under this premise?
Right.
McEnroe premise.
Like,
that tennis is built on this premise.
Right. And as long as you never, ever think about the people on the receiving end, it's so fun to just revel in the meanness and the nastiness and the drama, right? But there are actually people who make mere fractions of what players make, but are integral to the sport functioning.
Because they're not real people.
No.
They're just some guy in the chair.
Some guy in a chair.
Some guy in the chair. Some guy who is having all the power to make all these decisions that's going to affect me, the tennis player.
I was hopeful that that this could have been a turning point for how Andre approaches the sport? Because we've heard from his fans, you know, he's really struggling with this and he's trying to get a hold of it, and basically that he was above criticism. And I thought, well, this is an action that's so severe.
Well, even if it's not above criticism, y'all are criticizing too much. You've right. done it before. We've been down this road. I tweeted about this at the Australian Open and got people in my mentions saying, wow, how original.
Right. And sure.
Okay. He's working on it.
Well, he keeps doing
it. How dare you? Like, you're not helping the process. You're just here for clicks, for clout, da-da-da-da-da. Oh. So, like, every time this happens, and we have not seen a cessation, it has not stopped. Every time this happens, we're just supposed to give a blanket free pass because he's acknowledged working on it in the past.
Yeah. But, like, the hopes that this would be something deeply impactful for him were kind of dashed by the statement that we read today.
Correct.
And that could change. Like, we're only mere days out from the event. His view of that event might change. And for other players, it has.
All this is from people who have liked and supported Rublev in the past. So not that that needs to be a disclaimer.
It's so annoying that I even feel the need to mention that. Like, I am a fan. I actually am a fan of Rublev. In Santiago, something not dissimilar happened with Arthur Fils.
Maybe even worse?
Perhaps. He was, I guess, complaining about the state of the court itself. Like, the safety of the court.
It was a shit show of a court.
And, of course, no player should tolerate that. But again, we're talking about how you choose to express your emotions. Nobody is criticizing a player for having these emotions.
So, for right? example... It's... For example, I'm working Mother's Day as a server, and I have 4 or 5 tables. I have lots of difficult guests. It's busy out the wazoo, the busiest serving day of the year. And my manager seats me like 5 sections over, and I can't really get there. I'm super busy. I then say to him, are you fucking serious?
Right.
And go off on them and scream on them. That is not professional tennis. But that's how I relate it to my personal world. And I don't have any confidence that a professional tennis player would be able to handle that kind of stress. So don't come at me by saying these are not the same things, okay? I'm just saying we all deal with highly stressful situations, a lot of us, in our jobs. And we are bound by certain rules of decorum that we must abide in order to keep our jobs.
Mm-hmm. And in your example, your emotion was valid.
Absolutely.
However, the way that you chose to express it was not. And so I feel that a lot of umpires are out here gentle parenting these players, these adult players. And it's like, do you feel that was the best way for you to have reacted, honey? You know, with Fils, he is rightfully upset about the court, and how he chose to handle it was to take the supervisor and literally scream his head off in his face. Mm-hmm. And he said, I couldn't really hear what he said. He said, are you a fucking something? Over and over and over and over.
And then demanded, answer my fucking question.
Right. So if the same standards had been applied to Fils, he would have been defaulted easily. And I would have supported that as well. But we do, of course, have a problem of consistency in the way that some of these rules are enforced.
Do you end up with a placating umpire like Mohamed Layani trying right. to talk Kyrgios off the ledge? You know, like, or do you get somebody who is more Carlos Ramos? Do you get
right?
Maybe somebody woke up on the wrong side of the bed that day and did not have the bandwidth, and so their way of interpreting the rules, their discretion that day, necessarily isn't the same as it would have been maybe another day.
Right. There is ambiguity in the rules, and it's built in on purpose. If you want clarity, I think the penalties are going to get worse, honestly.
Fils was allowed to finish that match.
Yeah. Okay, I think that was enough time spent on Rublev's default.
Yeah, that was a lot of time on that issue.
Yes, let's move along.
Buried in the Dubai news was Andy Murray finally addressing directly the retirement question that he keeps getting asked over and over and over again, especially in the last 6 months as the losses kept piling up. He said that he's unlikely to play tennis past the summer, says he hopes to play the Paris Olympics, saying, quote, I get asked about it after every single match that I play, every single tournament that I play. I'm bored of the questions, to be honest. He won a match in Dubai and then lost to the champion, Hugo Humbert, in the second round. Quote, I don't have a clue what I'm doing.
Right. There was a lot of chatter during the match. His mom, Judy, hit back as well on Twitter saying, can you guys stop asking him this question every second? And I can see how demoralizing that can be for an athlete. And he has raised the prospect of his imminent retirement before. Most famously at the 2019 Australian Open, where he basically opened the tournament by saying, I don't know how much longer I'm going to be doing this, guys. This is probably my last Australian Open. He lost to Roberto Bautista Agut in the first round there. They even played a video tribute at the end of that match, assuming that he was done. His fellow players were giving tributes to him. And then he decided to stay in Australia and get that hip resurfacing.
Many ups and downs since then, which we've all seen. He returned to tennis in June 2019. He won Antwerp a few months later, beating Wawrinka. Reached three more ATP finals, Sydney in 22, Stuttgart that same year, and then last year in Doha. His best slam result since has been a third round at Wimbledon in 2021, as well as an Australian Open third round last year.
Most athletes do not get to leave sports on their own terms. Most flame out, most get injured, their bodies age and betray them. I just hope for Andy that he gets some celebration as he embarks on like his last stop at these events, some of which he's won.
More than that, I hope he finds some joy and fulfillment in his results, in the actual process of doing this, that it's at least somewhat enjoyable. There's this tired, oh, this is me going on one of my favorite tangents again. I know you know what's coming. This whole business of needing to retire at the top. Fans always want their faves to retire a la Pete Sampras. Go out on a high. Hell, people who aren't even fans of tennis, people who don't even watch the sport, still regurgitate that tired rubbish. I experience it all the time. And of course, life and sport are more complicated than that. People are human. They have wants, needs, desires. They've spent their entire lives, most of them from as young as 3 years old, to this one thing. It's why so many of them are emotionally stunted. It's the only thing that they know. And so the decision to give up that one thing that you know how to do, that you've done so well, that one thing that you will do better than anything else in your entire life going forward. You know that. That you will never do something as well as you did this one thing. Grappling with your body not allowing you to do that, even though your mind and your spirit and your will is willing. That's a hard thing. And so what resonates here with Andy answering this question in this way is the hurt. The emotional toll that these questions take on him. And perhaps we can now segue into a more celebratory moment for the rest of his career.
Let's talk about the Netflix slam. It was...
I watched it twice yesterday.
You
because
did.
Because you were out at a movie.
and I said, is it available for replay?
I watched it by myself. You came home pretty much right as it ended. And you said, well, I might as well watch it and get it out of the way. Like, well, great. I guess I'll stick around for that again.
And at that point, it wasn't allowing us to fast forward or anything. So I did have to watch the whole thing straight through.
30-minute preamble, yappa, 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 yappa.
Yes. This is a first-of-its-kind live streaming exhibition match on Netflix, which allegedly is kind of mulling the idea of making bids for live sporting events. Firstly, the video quality was very good, at least for us. Some people were sort of complaining about the production quality. James Gray in iNews lambasted the whole thing as being sort of like this tacky American thing, which to me is part of its charm. It was incredibly American. Yes, it was tacky. Yes, it was over the top. But what are you trying to accomplish by an event like this? You're trying to keep tennis fans excited, and you're also trying to attract maybe not total strangers, but people who maybe watch tennis every once in a while or have a passing familiarity with who these people are.
And so the narrative of aging legend, GOAT versus upstart. I heard the word upstart so many times. That was clearly a directive from somebody yesterday. Yes.
You mean a former number one and two-time major champion already?
Both from Spain, passing the torch. These framings were clearly to sell the event.
Right, because it's come at sort of an awkward time in both players' careers where Rafa is clearly on the way out. It was unclear if his body would even cooperate for this exhibition. He is not really passing the torch because he's not currently
holding the best torch. Player.
Exactly. Right. To continue the metaphor. And Alcaraz comes in with huge injury question marks as well. And in sort of, well, not a sophomore slump, but a slump. Hasn't reached a final since winning Wimbledon, which was such a mind-boggling achievement when it happened, and somebody who's dealing with how to maintain his body and deal with these seemingly constant injuries.
Mm. That said, the event delivered.
I agree. I mean, in spite of all of the excesses, I think it was overall a really cool thing. It's a spotlight that tennis doesn't often get.
They claim that they're going to do it maybe annually. We'll see how that translates to participants going forward. Will it always be an ATP-only event? Will they get Naomi Osaka versus Coco Gauff? Who are the players on the WTA Tour that you can script a narrative to sell an event like this? Because I don't think it works if you just throw Iga versus Sabalenka out there. Do you know what I mean? Or Sabalenka-Rybakina. Like, that would be prime time for us. But not necessarily for this medium and this type of event. I saw a lot of people complain about the audio mixing. Fair.
Yeah.
That was definitely a problem.
They had some trouble adjusting the crowd sound when something big happened. So you'd hear like a big burst and then it would be reduced quickly. However, tennis broadcasting has encountered the same issues too. So I'd say just give them some time to troubleshoot.
Complaints about the court. You're not going to get a brilliantly laid court, literally overnight. It's just not going to happen. Right.
I say, fair enough. Complain, I don't care. Complain about the court.
The actual match play, it was spotty from both players in quite a few moments. The serving wasn't great. That said, it's an exhibition. When Rafa drops his serve speed at the end of the second set, is it because, oh boy, is there an injury concern? Or is it, well, Carlos needs to win the second set so that we get to a super tie break and then we can entertain further. There was a mix of superb stroke play, match play, and also exhibition gimmickry. You know, like there isn't a whole lot that you can extrapolate from this performance, the play of both players, other than to say they both gave us highlight moments. They both highlighted some of the truly great aspects of their games. Some of those, well, two in particular, Rafa running forehand winners, screamers. What more can you ask for?
Right.
You get the maximum amount of play, a third set super tiebreak. You get casual viewers to see what these players can do, what makes them so great, while also having it be a lighthearted affair. You know, I think it worked. By and large.
Rafa's movement was poor by his own standards.
The anticipation was not there, which is to be expected.
Right.
We didn't really see that as an issue in Brisbane earlier in the year. I'm never not going to say that now.
Oh my God. Like it's spelled B-E-I-N. Bane.
Yes. His anticipation was pretty good in Brisbane earlier in the year. But here, when you factor in that they're both coming back from injury and they don't know this surface. It's an artificial surface.
Exactly.
You're not going to take chances in moving too quickly, too abruptly, changing directions when there's so much more at stake outside of this. You're just trying to show up, get through it, give a good account and move on.
Right.
So I don't know if we can say that that's a concern per se until we see him turn up at the next official event, which is at this point slated to be Indian Wells.
Right. I was hoping that he would pull out of Indian Wells to ensure he plays Miami because I'm going to be there and I'd like to see him there. He seems pretty committed to playing Indian Wells. So
he's Larry's buddy. That's not going to happen. It's not going to happen.
Larry might not be Indian Wells' buddy for too much longer.
Well, I mean, say, for example, Rafa loses early, still feels good about himself, and goes to Miami. That mm-hmm. could happen.
Yep, yep.
I just don't see a deep run in Indian Wells followed by playing Miami at this stage.
Right, right. All that to say, tennis leadership should be looking to get the sport in front of the most eyeballs it possibly can. If Netflix becomes a viable broadcasting partner, that would be a really interesting development.
But what if that partner is the Saudi Public Investment Fund? If that's what's enabling you to get the most eyeballs on tennis, James, what then?
Oh, I don't know.
You really stepped into that one, didn't you?
I don't have an answer for you. I guess it's all going to be Six Kings Slam. The ATP, I think you were referencing, just announced a 5-year partnership with the Saudi Public Investment Fund. And immediately, the Public Investment Fund grabs the naming rights to the ATP rankings. Just a week or so ago, it was called the Pepperstone ATP Rankings. Now it bears the snappy name, the PIF ATP Rankings. The brand, wow, the branding.
It is. It makes it me, just rolls off the tongue.
It certainly makes me want to go out and buy a...
A PIF?
A public investment fund.
The public investment fund will, quote, partner with ATP events, Indian Wells, Miami, Madrid, Beijing. And it's not surprising, given that last year it was reported that IMG was attempting to dump Miami and Madrid.
The Athletic reported at the time that the public investment fund was trying to purchase those two events off of IMG. That same day, the WTA Twitter account retweeted a very famous member of Nole Fam, who has blocked us. So we didn't actually see that. We only saw a screenshot. The tweet was in reference to, what about the WTA? And the person said, shortly to be announced in Saudi Arabia. That was not my error. That was theirs.
Okay.
It was a verbal SIC.
Somebody at the WTA thought they were on their personal Twitter account.
Is that what you think happened?
It happens to me all the time. Just last night, somebody, I was on the timeline for the body serve and I saw an account, which we actually mutually follow.
Okay.
Not you and I, but that account and the body serve follow each other. And they were auctioning off Ronald Acuna Jr. memorabilia.
Okay.
Of course, you know, I'm an Atlanta baseball team fan.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, if you follow and retweet, then you're entered into a draw. And I'd seen that there'd only been like 80 retweets. So like, I stand a good shot here. And so I immediately retweeted and then realized I retweeted from the body serve account. And so I undid the retweet, went to my personal account, and did it there.
Okay, thank you for that illustration. That was a long way to say somebody at the WTA fucked up badly.
They did, but I'm saying that's specifically how they fucked up, I think. That's my okay. theory.
That's just conjecture, to be clear. However, this person who was working on the WTA social media, who retweeted this thing, brought up an interesting point. What about the WTA? What is going on? Why, again, for the millionth year in a row, do we not have clarity on where the WTA finals are headed? Now, this person who was retweeted alleges that it's going in Saudi Arabia, and it'll be announced shortly. Forbes also reports that the WTA is in negotiations to play their finals in Saudi Arabia. That's not a huge surprise. We've heard that a lot. When is it going to be decided? When is it going to be announced? The women who play on this tour deserve to know.
This is timely because we got a message from one of our longtime listeners and big supporters. I don't know if we should mention them by name because I don't know if they would want that.
Mm-hmm. We can mention them on the next episode if they feel we've not given them the appropriate credit. But I don't want to say their name just, you know, willy-nilly.
Exactly. But I'm going to read exactly what they said because we could not say it better, essentially. I saw news circulating about Riyadh WTA. Everyone's going to be jumping all over each other to criticize WTA for this, but I hope people see that the time to make a moral stand was when soccer, Formula One, golf, ATP were making decisions. They technically had no need for lavish deals. Imagine men saying no to playing in Saudi Arabia until women have equal rights. How powerful that would have been. WTA took several steps back in prize money equality during the pandemic and with their China boycott, which ATP did not support. It's unfair to ask WTA to stay poor for morals when everybody else gets filthy rich.
A clarity of thought that we have rarely approached.
Us personally?
So I don't want to add much because I think that was a series of great points. And questions.
Which is also to say, you can have those comments and concerns and criticism for the WTA, but not without that other context.
Yep.
We're going to end the episode with some drugs. Your favorite.
My favorite. This past week, we heard that the ITIA nabbed a player currently ranked something like 1357 in doubles for testing positive for marijuana.
Not even singles.
No. He has no singles points to his name ever.
This person's name is Casey Kanya? Kania? Kanaya?
I don't know. Unfortunately, he doesn't even have a pronunciation guide on his ATP profile.
He's a former UNC player, suspended for 2 years after testing positive for cannabis, marijuana, Mary Jane, weed, reefer.
Ganja.
In August 2023 in Cary, North Carolina. His only career points and prize money were from that tournament, where he reached a doubles quarterfinal, and the ITIA accepts that the violation was not intentional. Otherwise, he'd have gotten a 4-year ban.
For weed.
Weed. So did somebody pass him a brownie, and he didn't really know what was what?
Well, it's interesting that you ask. The threshold for what intentional means is that the person knew their conduct was an anti-doping rule violation or knew that there was a significant risk that it could constitute or result in a rule violation and manifestly disregarded that risk. In this case, the ITIA, I imagine, could not prove, their evidence couldn't reach that threshold, that this person had manifestly disregarded the risk of an anti-doping rule violation. A lot of people have been talking about how unfair this is and how small potatoes it feels compared to real doping, right? When we talk about real serious doping, it's drugs that increase your production of red blood cells, that increase muscle tissue, anabolic steroids, SARMs, those kind of things. Marijuana doesn't really seem like a big deal, but the ITIA, like almost all sporting organizations across the world, follow WADA guidelines about what is a prohibited substance and what is not. And I think it's a good time for some refreshing our memories about why drugs get added to the banned list. Isn't that exciting?
Is this the DARE program? Is this a subsection of the DARE program?
You know what? Let me just keep my thoughts to myself.
Why? Because, you have a podcast.
Because
you're a man.
Every time I think about Nancy Reagan, it's the only thing I can think about.
That's the only thing? Not the throat goat?
I wasn't going to say
it. I feel like
I wasn't gonna be
she has
crass
been
and say it.
Completely rebranded in the last 5 years.
I wasn't going to do all that and say it out loud, but that's the only thing I can think of is just say yes.
She did.
Exactly. Allegedly. Nancy was a huge proponent of the Just Say No program.
I've always wondered this. This is from before. This predated the White House, right? This is from like back in
this
the Hollywood
allegedly
acting days.
In the acting days.
With like wild parties and stuff.
The studio days.
Good for her.
And right. I'm not slut shaming here. Refuse to do that. I'm Nancy Reagan shaming because she was horrible.
No disagreement from
exactly.
me. I just needed clarification on this one issue.
I hope that she and Margaret Thatcher are having fun right now. wherever they are.
We've talked about goats a lot on this podcast.
Correct. That's why this podcast bears an E rating. Not for everyone, for explicit. Let's get back to anti-doping. How about that? There was a lot of fair discussion about whether or not this was appropriate. Like, is this too much? And tennis is a bit hamstrung because cannabis is on the banned list provided by WADA. The criteria of what constitutes a banned substance is threefold. And you have to fulfill two of these three criteria. Got it? The first is the potential to enhance performance. The second is that the substance poses a potential risk to an athlete's health. And the third is that it violates the, quote, spirit of the sport.
Two and three are so vague.
So vague.
So vague.
And because you can...
How wonderful for them to be so concerned about the risk to an athlete's health. And the violating of the spirit of the sport. Do you know what violates the spirit of the sport? Screaming and yelling at line umpires.
Oh, we're not doing that.
Chopping down umpire chairs. Physically assaulting umpires.
Listen, but this is about...
Assaulting your domestic partners. Those things are contrary to spirit of the sport.
But we're talking about substances or methods right now. Okay. That's all. There is a lot of discussion in the scientific community about cannabis as a potential therapeutic drug, of course. The potential to enhance performance. Cannabis can decrease anxiety, fear, tension, and it can contribute to euphoria and confidence. Theoretically, these things could be helpful in sport. And scientifically, they've been shown to be helpful in sports that require high levels of concentration.
Mm-hmm. But what about needing to consume a lot of food on changeovers? What about the lethargy?
You can do that. You can order two smoothies and a sushi. Remember that?
Are you laying allegations?
No, I'm just saying that potentially you can order a lot of shit to your chair.
Okay.
But
I'm just saying, I understand on paper what this is saying, but from personal experience, this seems crazy to me.
What kind of personal experience do you have?
I'm a man of a certain age.
Okay.
Who's lived some life.
Who went to college in Ithaca, New York.
Exactly.
Anyway, I'm trying to talk about the science here.
Okay.
Trying to be serious.
We don't always take science as the be-all, end-all.
Oh, okay.
Just because they say, oh my God, I sound like an anti-vaxxer.
Yeah, facts.
Jesus.
Feelings are not facts, are not what? What is that? Anyway, the facts are that some athletes believe cannabis to be performance enhancing, but more research is needed. So it is unclear if it fulfills criterion number one, performance enhancing. The second is it deleterious to an athlete's health? Cannabis can impact coordination, movement, time estimation, and reaction times. This is if you're using cannabis in competition. There's obviously a risk while you're playing. Overall, long-term, there is decreased cognitive performance that's been shown in research. If you're a smoker, there can obviously be implications to your cardiovascular system. But again, more research is needed, and a lot of research is currently being done. And the third, and the most difficult to define, is the spirit of the sport. Does using this substance violate fair play, ethics? Is it in the character of the sport? Does it demonstrate commitment and dedication? Does it rise to community standards? And you can see how difficult those things are to define.
What if the community standards have to do with playing a tournament where you're tested in a city or a state where it's legal?
Right. But still, across the world, most countries, it's not legal. But there's been a very rapid movement in Western countries over the past few years to legalize or decriminalize marijuana. You know, how long does that spirit of the sport thing stay in effect? Overall, I think we're into another question of proportionality. Of course, players are required to abide by the rules and understand what's on the banned list, but the ITIA is stuck. They have to implement a ban if a player tests positive, according to their rules. If the violation was intentional, they have to implement a 4-year ban. if they're going by the letter of the law. If not, it's a 2-year ban.
Sure. It just seems so utterly ridiculous.
I agree. I think there needs to be a policy change in this to allow...
I wanted that to be clear.
Oh, yeah. No. I was just...
Because it seemed like a lot of explaining to justify.
I was only explaining just to clarify like what the rules actually are in the current state. But I'm not trying to argue that the policy should stay how it is.
Okay.
Right? I don't really think that cannabis is all that performance enhancing. I think there are benefits to having tiers of banned substances. And I know that would take a lot more judgment calls from the people in charge. But is cannabis on the same level as an anabolic steroid, for example?
It just seems to me that recreational drug use, as it pertains to professional sport, has always fallen into the category of moral judgment.
Yes.
And it's cloaked in these arbitrary, vague rules that people get to interpret however they want.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me...
I mean,
are these people out here working at a meth lab? Like, you know, like when you're talking about like deleterious to an athlete's health or violating the spirit of like societal rules, yeah, a meth lab is bad. Being on meth is bad, objectively.
Very unhealthy.
Right?
Yeah.
But let's be for real
here.
You
took like a THC gummy at home one night and watched TV? Okay. The other thing with THC is that you could have done it 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And it's still in your system. You could still test positive. And it varies based on the strain. Long after the beneficial effects, the alleged beneficial effects have disappeared, you're still testing positive, mm-hmm. which I feel like needs to be treated with some nuance.
By and large, the response has been incredulity. But what we're seeing too, specifically from Tyson Kwiatkowski, is again a reference to amphetamines.
Yeah.
There is this belief from a lot of people in tennis that the use of amphetamines is rampant, specifically medications for ADHD that are actually beneficial to... They're performance enhancers.
Yeah, they are banned substances.
You can get TUEs because of a diagnosis. And the allegation here is that everybody's got a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are anecdotal things that Tyson is repeatedly invested in bringing up. Last year, he shared a Time story on Adderall shortages and quoted it with, quote, probably because every tennis player is taking it. And then he tweeted about it again with Kanaya's suspension.
Mm-hmm. Riley Opelka tweeted about it. It first came about widely because Fernando Verdasco was suspended for a very short period over something like this. Of course, therapeutic use exemptions are confidential and they should be confidential. But players
no,
are...
I repeat yourself. I'd like to hear you ask me about my drugs.
But players are repeatedly alleging that, oh, everybody out here is on some type of Adderall or Ritalin or some stimulant that's connected to an ADHD diagnosis, which they feel is bogus. I'm not going to be out here repeating that kind of allegation without evidence because I feel it's reckless. And I also think...
Well, we just did.
Sure. Well, no, but I'm not going to say that, oh, they're on something, because I don't know.
Okay.
Right, that's just what they said. I also know that the incidence of neurodivergence is probably a lot higher than you think.
Way underdiagnosed.
Yeah.
How many people do we know in our personal lives who in their mid to late 30s, contemporaries or peers, who've been diagnosed
who've discovered
recently?
Later in life.
And it's like, oh my God, wow, this makes so much sense. My life is so much better.
All right. So I'm not going to go out and say, oh, I think your diagnosis is bogus, because I have no frame of reference for that. But don't expect that discourse to go away anytime soon. Mm.
Well, that's it. That's episode 335. My name is Jonathan. You can find me on Twitter at tennis_John.
I'm James.
Oh, you stuttered. You stumbled there for a bit. Yeah. You forgot.
I'm James at Elliot JMR.
Two L's, two T's, right?
And next episode, This Got Punted, going to be talking about the Czech Federation getting raided. What?
Yeah.
We're also going to be talking about this WTA sexual abuse case, where allegedly they're trying to prevent Pam Shriver from testifying. That'll be on the next episode.
You can find everything BodyServe related at linktree.com/thebodyserve. Look out in the mail coming soon, for those who are receiving postcards and bookmarks, we have an envelope seal that I'm just so giddy about.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, you're going to have to break it and ruin it.
Yes.
To see the...
But you can take a picture before.
Thanks for listening.
Till next time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.